Call the House Committee on Health Care and Subcommittee on Health Policy to order. And just a little matter of business. I just wanted to announce publicly that we will not be hearing House Bill 3487 on Thursday, March 29th. It is currently on the agenda. We will not be hearing that. There will be a revised agenda being issued. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3416. And just that we have a full house today, it's good to see you all. The plan is to devote an hour to 3416. And there are some folks who have signed up to testify, and I'm going to ask people to go through quickly because we have some other bills we need to hear. And so just to give you a forewarning, I have a timer. Sandy, would you like to introduce the bill for us here?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 3416 is at the request of Representative Galizio. It establishes an acuity-based patient classification system for certain health care facilities. It imposes a minimum nurse-to-patient staffing ratio in specified facilities, and those facilities are identified in the bill. It authorizes the Department of Human Services to adopt rules that a facility is to adopt dissemination to direct care registered nurses. It requires facilities to file the specific reports about the system, impose the penalties for violation, and punishes has a punishment of falsification of the required documents by a maximum imprisonment of 1 year, $6,250 fine, or both, and this becomes effective on January 1, 2009. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Sandy. And with that, we're going to start off with our opening panel, and I'd like to call up Donette McLeod, Matthew Ray, Karen Farai, and Linda Ebby. Actually, why don't we do two of you at a time since we only have two mics. So how about Donette and Matthew first? And if you would, just state your name for the record when you speak, and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Donette McLeod, and I've been in healthcare for 30 years, 6 years as a nurse's aide, and 24 as an RN. I presently work both at Legacy Emanuel and at Sunnyside Kaiser. I work in the post-anesthesia care unit, otherwise known as the recovery unit. I'm here today representing the United Nurses of Legacy and AFT Healthcare Northwest 5017. I want to thank you all for listening to our testimony on this important legislation. I'll be talking about what brought us here today, what the changes in our work life have happened that we feel like it's necessary to have laws to protect patients and nurses. About 20 years ago, healthcare changed dramatically when we were subjected to managed care. And what happened was that it really affected the way nurses could deliver care in the hospitals. Before that, the restructuring of our work, you know, industries and hospitals weren't usually mentioned in the same sentence, but now it is an industry, and even as we've moved forward, it's a bottom-line industry that oftentimes forgets patients' lives. 20 years ago, registered nurses were at the bedside to deliver care to the sick, and we were able to utilize our professional judgment and skills to anticipate the healthcare needs of our patients, to teach and to deliver individualized care based on the patient's psychosocial, cultural, and spiritual, physical needs. And it takes time at the bedside to be able to do that. It's not just rushing in, rushing out, and having the nurse's aide do the majority of your work. You need to be at the bedside to assess those needs. The consequences of these structural changes have been widely studied, and research has overwhelmingly supported RN's assertions that they no longer feel they can deliver safe patient care. As the acuity of our patients has increased, and our workloads have increased dramatically. We have more patients. The patients are much sicker than they ever were. What you see now in the hospital are patients that were either 20 years ago dead or in the ICU. And we're sending patients home that used to spend 10 days in the hospital. You know, after a surgery, they go home the same day. So the turnover rate in the hospital for patients is very quick, and that really means that we need to be at the bedside even more, because you're sending patients home sicker, and they need more teaching. So while they're there, they really need us at the bedside. And as our workloads have increased, so has the burnout. And because of the burnout and job dissatisfaction, what you find is a high turnover rate, which is not good for patient care at all, as you have nurses churning through the systems in the hospital. You just cannot provide the same level of care when you're always orienting that new nurse. You know, it's just not the same as if you have an established staff in the hospital. In 1999, the president of the Kaiser Family Foundation concluded that there's a great deal of inappropriate care in the healthcare system, and it has been the managed care industry that has taken on the unpopular job of controlling costs. But then he went on to say that patients have been caught in the middle. A survey conducted in response to the growing nursing shortage by the Kaiser Foundation and the Harvard School of Public Health in 1999 concluded that managed care had decreased patients' ability to see specialists, had decreased the amount of time nurses spent with their patients, and had decreased the quality of care for people who are sick. There have been many responses to these changes in the healthcare systems, and we believe the most significant is the regulatory changes that have taken place in California with the mandatory minimum staffing ratios. We feel like this is what will really ensure that our patients receive the care that they deserve. And although we appreciate our elected officials' response to these concerns with the passage of House Bill 2800, we and the United Nurses of Legacy and AFT Healthcare Northwest were very involved in the implementation process last summer and testified at the final hearing. We understood that the legislature's reason for the passage of House Bill 2800 was to address the nursing shortage by strengthening the whistleblower language and to curb the use of mandatory overtime. We also knew that setting up committees to address these issues, especially in non-union hospitals, would harm nurses who spoke out. They're not safe to say what they really feel in these hospitals. I work at Legacy Emanuel. I wouldn't feel safe to say what I really felt about the staffing. We also testified that without real regulatory reform on staffing itself, hospitals' bottom line would dictate how they self-regulated. When the final rules came out this last fall, despite the objections of many of the original sponsors, letters from RNs, and hours of painstaking review, we had to conclude that House Bill 2800 would do little to change the delivery of care in our state. We believe House Bill 3416, the Safe Staffing Act, will change the ability for RNs to provide patient care in a safe and meaningful way. Along with the minimum staffing ratio, the transparency that is integral to this bill will ensure that the citizens of Oregon will receive appropriate and safe nursing care. You'll be hearing stories from RNs as they talk about their lives under the current healthcare system. They're not always pretty stories, and some of them can be quite scary if you consider that you might have been that patient. I think they're important stories for citizens, patients, and representatives to hear. Nurses are really committed to our patients. You know, we don't go into it for money, and you work too hard. And we are so dedicated to our patients that, you know, we're all willing to come up here today to talk about why this is so important to us, to our patients. Nurses quit because they don't feel like they can give good patient care. It's just, it ruins your life. It creates so much stress when you walk away and know you didn't do what that patient needed. So we feel like with the passage of House Bill 3416 that we'll be better able to advocate for our patients and their families, advocate for patient safety, ensure that patients and their families receive the appropriate physical, cultural, spiritual care that they deserve, and that we can proactively meet our patients' needs. Instead of waiting till there's a problem, we can anticipate those needs, and that we can have the time that's necessary to do proper patient teaching so people are able to go home from the hospital and not return, that they truly understand what they need to do to take care of themselves. We see too much of the revolving door. We also need time to correctly and timely fill out doctor's directives. We need to spend the time to recruit, but also retain the experienced nurses at the bedside. We need to sustain a full-time RN staff as a core of the nursing units. We need to also ensure that time is given to education and ongoing skills training and preceptorship for the young nurses coming on. We want to make them successful so they can take care of us. And we also want to ensure workplace safety. Too many RNs get hurt on the job. There's not enough bodies to help lift our growing population. We need extra people on the floor. And I want to thank you all for hearing our testimony today.
Well, thank you, Donna. I appreciate you being here, and for all the other legacy nurses, yourself included. I want to thank you. My mom was at Legacy Emanuel in Good Sam for about a month, mm-hmm. and you all took very good care of her, so thank you. Any questions for Donna?
Matthew.
My
name's Matthew Ray, R-A-E. I'm going to speak just for a moment to provide an overview of the bill and also to allow as much time for the RNs that are in the room to have an opportunity to tell their stories. I work with AFT Healthcare, which represents 70,000 RNs across the country. In Oregon, I work with the American Federation of Teachers, Local 5017, OpenHP, and we represent 3,000 RNs and health professionals. Across the country, this is 3416 is based upon model legislation, which is AFTs introduced in several states. Here, we believe it's very important because the same problems with staffing we're facing across the country that inspired this legislation we're facing in Oregon. The legislation attempts to improve staffing in three key ways. The first is that it looks to address the staffing issue by establishing an absolute bare number of RNs per patients in given hospital departments. So there's a series of ratios which are in the actual legislation, as you'll see. Secondly, it requires that hospitals have staffing plans and staffing committees so that RNs can be part of the process in identifying units in which there's particularly high acuity or particularly high patient need so that they can even staff to meet those needs. It gives it the flexibility to do that. The second component of the legislation is that it requires that hospitals make their staffing public. Similar legislation was passed in Vermont, and the idea is to make competition in the healthcare marketplace based upon quality of care indicators as well as others. We know what's in our food and we know what's in our water. We should know what type of care we can receive in a hospital. The third protection that it provides for nurses is that it provides protection for a nurse who's given an assignment in which she doesn't have proper education or experience. So there may be an extremely talented and gifted RN who works in an ICU unit who isn't qualified to take care of a patient in another unit. Right now, frequently, hospitals will float an RN into that department. So it asks DHS to create a process in which, you know, a nurse could refuse to take an assignment in which it was unsafe for her to do that, or him. You know, that's kind of the basic three components of the legislation. If there are no questions, Chair Kotuck, I'd love to give the opportunity to the rest of the RNs in the room to tell their stories.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Questions? Specifics on the bill for Matthew? Thank you, because we do have a lot of folks signed up.
I did bring some copies.
Lisa, thank you. So with that, Karen Furry and Linda Fergie, thank you. And Linda Ebby. Mm-hmm. strength does that have to turn on?
My name is Karen Fergie. I've been a nurse for 23 years, and I work for Kaiser Permanente. I have a passion for nurses and a passion for nursing. I want young people to choose nursing as a profession. Nursing right now is not an attractive profession for people because the staffing in our hospitals doesn't allow for people to do their jobs the right way. We do minimum care for our patients because we don't have time to do the best care. This is not the kind of nursing that I want to give, and it's not the kind of nursing that I want my family and friends to receive. You're going to hear from a number of my colleagues today about how staffing affects our lives and our patients' lives. What I would like to do is answer some questions for you that you may have about House Bill 3416. You may have heard that the nurse staffing ratios cost too much and will make hospitals go out of business or divert money from other crucial services. This is not the case. It's not been the case in California. There's an increasing evidence that staffing ratios are actually cost-effective. One hospital in California went from a 50% vacancy rate for nurses to a 1% vacancy rate within 6 months of improving its ratios. Nurses want to work in facilities that allow them to give good, safe nursing care to their patients. Staffing ratios may also increase healthcare costs, may decrease healthcare costs by shortening hospital stays for patients, decreasing the on-the-job injuries for nurses, and reduce the amount of nurse turnover. Hospitals spend millions of dollars a year to recruit and train new RNs, yet lose them to burnout and injury, and they leave to go someplace else to work. The next question I'd like to address is the flexibility in the bill. Minimum staffing ratios for frontline managers allows for frontline managers to have enough staff to respond to all the unexpected crises that happen in a hospital on a daily basis, such as injuries and unexpected absences. Flight attendants on airplanes and certified nurses' assistants have ratios. A job as important as nursing should also have them. It's been said that enacting minimum staffing rules would cause the minimum staffing to become the maximum staffing. It's really as silly as it sounds. Managers will still be responsible for ensuring that there are enough nurses on a floor to meet the care needs of the patients. A minimum does not allow managers to act irresponsibly. Right now in hospitals in Oregon, fall short of the staffing ratios. So this minimum would be a great improvement to the patient care that we have now. You're probably asking yourself how nurse staffing ratios will impact the nursing shortage. What you need to know is that most nurses go into nursing because it gives them the opportunity to make people's lives better. However, if a nurse has to work in a hospital today that is short-staffed, that nurse cannot give the kind of nursing that we all want to give. This leads to nurse burnout. With staffing ratios enacted, nurses would stop leaving nursing and would again find this a desirable profession. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
I think we'll do all three of you and then
yeah,
questions.
Yeah, I think my name got...
No, it's good. You were next on the list, Kathy. So whoever wants to go first, Linda or Kathy.
You pick.
Okay, I'll go.
Go.
I'm nervouser than you.
That's fine.
Okay. We're friendly crowd.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. Well, Chair Kotek and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Linda Eby, and I'm an instructor of nursing at Portland Community College. Also, for the past several years, I've served as secretary of AFT Oregon. And at a national level and in the state of Oregon, AFT members support the values behind House Bill 3416. And I came here today to be an advocate for both nurses and patients in Oregon. My point of view is that of a nurse who's been practicing registered nursing in Oregon for 31 years, who has been teaching registered nurses for 21 years. So I think I have the right to talk a little bit about historical perspectives on the practice of nursing and staffing issues in Oregon, since being older than dirt probably gives me that opportunity.
Just experience.
Yes, it's just experience, yes. Well, what I'm going to do to save time and save repetition is just to kind of go to where my unique perspective is as a teacher. And at Portland Community College, where I teach, we have an advisory board, which is made up of representatives from different facilities that hire new graduate nurses. And this board meets with us three times a year for the purpose of reminding us or for teaching us about what the current job description is for registered nursing, and also for letting us know whether our graduates are adequately prepared to become registered nurses, you know, when they graduate from PCC. And around the early 1990s, our advisory board started telling us that our school and other schools' graduates were really not prepared for delegating patient care to unlicensed personnel. And so that was their main complaint, was that we needed to teach our students to be able to delegate to unlicensed personnel. And I'm referring mostly in this field to certified nursing assistants, or CNAs. You know, before 1985, before Medicare changed and reimbursement changed and diagnostic-related groups defined how many days people could stay in the hospital, there were virtually no certified nursing assistants in the acute care hospitals. So we, trying to catch up with the times, changed the nursing curriculum in response to changes in practice. Their next suggestions of the advisory board were that new graduates' organizational skills and productivity were not adequate. So now the new graduates are newly not able to take on the full patient load of a registered nurse. You know, we all knew that this was about the workload increasing. You know, we have a program. I'm from an associate degree program, and in their last quarter of their nursing education, our students do a preceptive clinical experience where they work with a registered nurse, and over the course of that term, they take on the full responsibility and full duties of an RN. And so suddenly, the staff at the facilities where we were taking our students and the clinical instructors were saying that they were going to change the rules, and now instead of taking on the full duties of an RN, they would take one less patient. The students would take one less patient than the regular RNs because they were just not capable of covering all the details and doing all the work that the regular RN did and making all the assessments that a regular RN did. And the scary part of that is that was the end of their nursing education, you know, so within a matter of weeks or months, they were going to go from not being able to take the full load of an RN to being a graduate registered nurse whose job it would be to be a full RN. Another issue is that graduate nurses often call me or email me to let me know how their first job as a nurse is going. And one of them called in tears recently and said that she'd been put on probation for working too slowly. And that was never a problem for her in school. A very bright person, had good organizational skills as far as we could tell in nursing school. But when she got out into the real world, she just couldn't make it. She just couldn't do the work as fast or as much as the workplace expected her. Another case which worries me more than the first, is a lot more, is one where the graduate said that at her job they use computer charting, and in the computer charting process, the forms that they fill out have little boxes that you check when different assignments have been done, when you've done certain assessments, and when you've given medications, and when you've done certain care activities for the patient. And she told me that she checks all these little boxes even when she doesn't do all the care, mm-hmm. because her orienting nurse told her that this is the only way that you get everything done, and it's the only way to keep your job. So The management at her facility thinks she's doing all these things. She's legally signing that she's doing all these things, and she's not. I've also heard several horror stories from graduates about changes in patient condition that have been noticed by CNAs, the nursing assistants, but not reported quickly enough to registered nurses because the CNAs didn't recognize the severity of the situation. You know, one of those cases was one where it involved leaking of chemotherapy medication. So the CNA didn't realize how different that was from a regular IV that they see every day, and how when some of it's lost, you don't know what kind of if the dose should be changed for the patient or not, or if the patient's tissues are damaged, or that sort of thing. So it could be really important as far as the patient's outcome is concerned. So the State Board of Nursing has responded by increasing the curriculum of the CNA to include more disease processes. The hospitals have responded by trying to decrease the amount of time people spend documenting and charting and that kind of thing by creating computer charting programs, which at best still take nurses 30 minutes per client, 30 minutes a patient per shift to get the charting done, I'm not saying that there are any villains here. I'm saying that, they're just in the healthcare industry. It just does not seem to be enough money to pay all the bills, and decreasing the number of registered nurses seems to be an industry-wide approach at kind of short-term sighted money saving. Last week, I filled out a new graduate reference form that asked me to. She was trying to get hired as a new RN, and the form asked me to rate the candidate's ability to conserve patient care resources. So I think that tells us, that's right. It's right there on their job application. Times are changing, so hospitals are trying to simplify things, but it's just not working. And people, as she says, are leaving the profession in droves. I think it's their loss of job satisfaction that's doing that. And I'm really here to say that we've reached the maximum amount of patient care responsibility that a registered nurse can reasonably take on. I don't think you can't give a registered nurse 10 patients with 10 nursing assistants and expect that the registered nurse can do the skilled part of the care of all those patients. There is some new research. There's a study called the Aiken study, AIKEN, if you want to Google it, which said that if an RN in a mixed medical surgical setting has more than 4 patients, then the morbidity and mortality of the patients increases. There's another, and whether or not CNAs are present, it doesn't matter. 4 patients was the limit there. Another study where the principal investigator was Jack Needleman. This study at Harvard showed that they did a huge study with in 11 states in the United States, and they looked at outcomes potentially sensitive to nursing. And what they found was that in all 11 states, there were strong and consistent relationships found between nurse staffing variables and 5 patient outcomes. That is urinary tract infections, pneumonia, length of hospital stay, upper gastrointestinal bleeding, and shock in medical patients. And in surgical patients, the only relationship between staffing and an outcome was the relationship between staffing and failure to rescue, which means that failure to resuscitate a patient who ultimately died. So these things are statistically are correlated with nurse staffing. The Needleman study didn't specify the number of nurses, but they said when you moved from low to high RN staffing, it was associated with a 2-25% reduction in outcomes that were potentially sensitive to nursing, these outcomes of infections and bleeding and that sort of thing. So I think that it's time that we agree that nurses do have a maximum workload, and that we move from this subject to other creative ways that we might be able to reduce healthcare costs, and that'll be subject for a future testimony. I think that just that my final point is that the maximum already has been reached, and nurses just can't take any more.
thanks, Ms. Eby. Thank you very much.
Certainly. And thank you for the opportunity to speak. I appreciate it.
Kathy. Yes. Is it Giroux?
Yes. My name is Kathy Giroux. My last name is spelled G-E-R-O-U-X. I have a French Canadian name, but I'm actually Irish. Okay?
So,
want that for the record. St. Patrick's Day is come and gone. Anyways, I have been a registered nurse for more than 25 years. I am currently the president of AFT Healthcare Northwest 5017, which is also known as OFNHP. I represent 3,000 members. The priorities that I have had since I've been president have been, one, that patients are taken care of in a safe environment all the time, not just sometimes. And secondly, that the nurses that take care of the patients have an environment that is safe for them to do their job in. Currently, we don't have that happening out there. I have many, many war stories that I won't go into, so I'll forget then and I'll go to now. Because of the nurses and the other healthcare professionals that I represent, especially at Kaiser Permanente, we were able, because they are part of a union, we were able to negotiate staffing language in our contract. Kaiser decided, as an organization, looking at what happened in California, and we know they have people in California, decided to adopt what the California legislation had mandated. And so at Kaiser, the nurses and the other healthcare workers actually decide and do joint staffing together to come up with what's the appropriate level that they need to take care of these patients. Everyone knows we're all struggling out there. We're all struggling out there. You know, all I keep on hearing about, and everybody hears about, the nursing shortage, the baby boomers, the mass exodus that's going to happen. Well, the way the environment is, mostly hospitals out there, the exodus is happening. We're adding to it. We're driving nurses out of the profession. You know, they didn't come into the profession to do what is now supposed to happen out there. And we hear it all the time. People do cry. I remember many years ago at home, my heart just racing, getting on the phone, calling somebody and saying, did I do this? Did I do that? Could you check on this? You couldn't even sleep. I mean, that is the life of many nurses every day out there. I don't care if they work days or they work nights. It's just the environment. And people can't handle it for any length of time. Another priority is that our union is successful in helping the nurses that work for the legacy healthcare system organize and have a union so they have a voice. I also am going to acknowledge, because I've been part of this, we do have a House Bill 2800. You know, it's good bill. It's a bill to me that doesn't have teeth. In a setting like legacy right now, it is meaningless to them. Nothing different is happening in the world other than it's getting worse. If we're going to rely on that by itself, it's not going to work. There's no acuity associated with that. We have to at least come to the point where nurses go in every day, no matter if it's day, evenings, or nights, weekends, whatever, and they know what to expect because they already know they have to deal with the unexpected, but they at least should be able to deal and know what they're going to have for an assignment so that they can manage their assignment. That is not happening consistently out there, and it's getting worse. So I'm not going to waste any more time. You know I'm supportive of this bill. This bill has to happen. I'm hoping that you'll hear such a compelling case before the hearing's done that you'll understand and you'll be able to support it. So thank you.
Thank you. Also, questions for the panel? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question for Ms. Fergie. In your written testimony, you talked about how there's an increasing evidence that staffing ratios are actually cost-effective. One hospital in California went from a 50% vacancy rate for nurses to a 1% vacancy rate within 6 months, and I'm trying to figure out how that's cost-effective. If you could explain that, that would be useful. Because it seems like what you're saying is that they hired more nurses.
They hired more nurses.
How is...
Because when you don't have the staff hired on, you use agency nurses, which are much more expensive than having your own staff. The second thing is that recruitment is a very costly thing to have done, because what you do is you go out and search countrywide. We do advertisement, and so that is a real high cost. Mm-hmm. Hospitals spend millions of dollars every year to recruit and retain nurses. Mm-hmm. Then you have to train the nurse. Because each hospital is different, each hospital has different policies and procedures, so you have to have a period of time where you train that nurse. So if you train the nurse and in 6 months she leaves, then you have to retrain someone to take her place. So you're continually doing that. Instead of being up to full staff, where you don't keep losing people all the time and having to continually replace them, you have people who are experienced and know what they're doing, and you can not spend all that extra money to replace people all the time. So it's a huge savings for hospitals.
Thank you.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question for Ms. Eby. I was especially concerned during your testimony when you talked about students that had contacted you, this idea of checking boxes for care that hasn't been completed. Are there sanctions or penalties, civil or criminal, either for nurses who do that or for management that encourages their staff to falsify medical records? And are what ability do nursing staff have to push back on management if they're being asked to engage in activities which are not just unsafe but probably also not legal?
Mm-hmm. Well, the short version is I don't know the whole answer to that or most of the answer to that question. What I do know is that for that person who was a registered nurse by the time she called me, my advice to her was to actually, you know, to go to her manager and say, I'm just not able to get all the work done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, just so the truth could be known, you know, and I'm sure that there are sanctions. There must be some sort of sanctions about that sort of thing that happen when, usually I think that it happens when someone suffers and they find that out afterward. I don't know. Sorry.
Can I follow up briefly? I think I'm concerned about that, both for the issue of the potential negative outcome for the patient, who people may be assuming the care is being delivered when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it also becomes a problem in terms of highlighting the very issue that nurses face in terms of recognizing what's not getting done. It seems like systemically, if the boxes weren't checked, it would become clear through a pattern that there were things that there weren't time to do, which in itself would be a pretty strong signal that there's a significant need.
It would seem so, but in fact what happens is that if the boxes aren't checked, the nurse is blamed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So the nurse is blamed for not having all his or her work done during that shift.
Mm-hmm.
And people
mm-hmm.
are reprimanded for that. You know, that's the sort of thing. People lose their jobs over not getting your work done, you know, that sort of thing.
It's much easier to blame the nurse than it is to blame the system.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And nurses blame each other. You know, you don't even need management to to start this blaming business. You know, you have David, who's a nurse, who he never does seem to check this part about listening to the patient's lungs at such and such a time, or he, you know, maybe he gives his medications late or that sort of thing. And what'll happen is that rather than going to David to say, you know, what can I do to help you, something like that, you've maybe heard of this concept of lateral aggression. Yeah, so when people feel like they feel powerless, they feel like they're unable to speak to their superiors, then they have aggression toward each other, and that is pretty rampant in the profession.
You know, there's another kind of blame that happens, too, is that a lot of times nurses are caught up trying to deliver the care and doing the things and don't get to the chatting.
Mm-hmm.
So we've always been told from dirt day, if you didn't write it or check it off, it didn't happen. Okay? So you caught in that, what do you do? Okay? You choose to, you take it one end or the other, you do the care. Okay? But I'm just saying that fear, either way, there's no win for you. You can't go to a manager or, you know, and say, that's your ticket out the door. Okay, we need to have a discussion. You're now in corrective action, or, you know, you're on the discipline track, but obviously you're too slow or too old or too whatever they say to you. But I'm just saying that's the environment registered nurses live in. There's nobody that's saying that, oh, how can we help you solve this problem? That's not out there, so.
Yeah, and I also want you to know that we're not encouraging that kind of thing to happen.
Good.
I don't want to get people focused on this, but I mean, that should give you the magnitude of this a problem. Okay? That's what we're really trying to get across.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to try to call a few more people up. Thank you very much for your testimony. So, I have about another 20 minutes. I want to call up a few more of we had a pre-sign-up list for some of the nurses. I'm going to try to get a few more of those, and then, be fair, I have to hear from the opposition on the bill. So, I'd like Kathy Sharp, Linda Boley, and Verity Caruso. And if you have written testimony, I would ask that you summarize it, because you can hand it out to us and then just hit the high points. That would be great, because then that leaves a little more time for a couple other people. So, thank you. I know you all have compelling stories, and it's hard to get them all in. So, Ms. Sharp, would you like to start?
Sure. I'm Kathy Sharp. I've been a nurse for 33 years. I've worked 29 of those at Good Samaritan in Portland. And I would like you to support House Bill 3416 because of two specific things. I'm going to talk about accountability and enforceability. And I think that one of the best things about it would provide staffing prepared in consultation with the large majority of the direct nurses in each unit. And currently with House Bill 2800, they have the manager and one nurse working on that staffing committee for the whole hospital. And it would be good to have more nurses involved, because then you have the specialty, the expert in that specialty involved in staffing that unit. Another step forward is the auditor evaluation tool. And at first I thought, oh gosh, if we have another bill, we'll have more documentation to do. But it seems to me that when you're looking at staffing, they're already doing that documentation, that every hospital has a plan of how many staff are on the unit, because they do it for their budget. And doing it for actual patient ratios would also, besides just a budgetary evaluation of the staffing, it could give you a patient outcome evaluation of the staffing, and that would be really important. Permanently posting the staffing plan and having a number where people, that means patients and their families, can access it and complain or whatever to the Department of Health Services, that would be great. And investigation within 24 hours, that's quite timely. Staffing ratios could be used by hospitals as a positive, as a marketing tool. But I like the idea, as things are legislated, that they're enforceable. Because if we legislate things that would have no enforcement and no follow-up, then it's just kind of a waste of time. It's a nice suggestion, but without any enforcement, it doesn't work. Nurses are the largest numbers of healthcare workers, and it doesn't mean that we're the most expensive. I think we provide economical, upfront, and personal, making a difference healthcare every day. And we're not what's wrong with healthcare. We provide what's stable. And I guess that's just about it. I should be quiet. Go for it.
Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate the brevity. Everyone's good.
Okay. In my written testimony, I have two instances that I've come up with why I'm supporting this, and I'll read the shorter one because of time. My name is Verity Caruso, and I live in Dundee, and I've been working as a nurse here in Oregon since 2000. In nursing, we use a variation of the golden rule called the mom test. Instead of treating our patients how we'd like to be treated, we take it up a notch, and we give the nursing care we'd want our moms to get if they were in the hospital. A few years ago, when I was working in an intensive care unit, I was assigned to care for a postpartum mother. The mother had had trouble with her delivery, and her premature baby was sent to Portland for a higher level of care than our small hospital could provide. There was no room in our OB department for this mother, so they transferred her to the ICU. This woman deserved an OB nurse, but instead she got me. She was on an IV magnesium drip to help manage her severe pregnancy-induced hypertension. This made me extremely uncomfortable. I was not cross-trained to the mother-baby unit. I had not particularly liked my OB rotation in nursing school, which is why I had chosen not to be cross-trained to the OB unit. And having no children of my own, I couldn't even draw from personal experience. Now I was supposed to manage a postpartum mother on a magnesium drip. I hadn't felt for uterine fundus since nursing school. How often was I supposed to feel for it? And was I supposed to massage it? Just how much vaginal bleeding was normal after delivery? Were we supposed to pump her breast milk? And if so, how often? And just plain how? These are all things trained OB nurses know like the back of their hands. There were many things I didn't know, but there was one thing I was well aware of. I was failing the mom test miserably. About halfway into my shift, I remembered something about testing deep tendon reflexes when caring for patients on magnesium drips. That's 6 hours of missed assessments that could have caused this woman severe trouble. Luckily, it didn't. By the grace of God, this woman and I made it through our shift together. I complained about caring for an OB patient to the house supervisor, and I was accused of being lazy. Anyone who knows me knows I have a strong work ethic. The truth was, I was as qualified to care for this woman as our OB nurses were to care for someone having an acute MI, my specialty. I wasn't. This hasn't happened often in my career, but it has happened, and I know it has happened to more than just me. I urge you to pass this bill and help stop unsafe practices like this in our Oregon hospitals. Thank you.
Thank you.
Linda. Okay, next. Thank you also for hearing my testimony regarding House Bill 3416, the Safe Staffing Act. And I've been a, my name is Linda Boley, by the way. I've been a RN for 30 years, mostly in the legacy system. And I've currently been working at Legacy Good Sam for 29 years. I work the day shift in ambulatory procedures where we do mostly pre- and post-operative surgery care. And generally I have about 6 to 8 patients per 8-hour shift, one of the last 8-hour shifts left in the hospital. This can vary depending on the day and the census and the number of nurses scheduled. And my responsibility for these patients are basically taking care of them preoperatively, which includes doing physical assessments, ordering and drawing lab work, ordering and EKGs, starting IVs, administering prescribed medicines, and also communicating any pertinent information to their surgeon and their anesthesiologists. Postoperatively, we monitor vital signs for any complications, bleeding, hemorrhage, infection, and we give medications as prescribed, a lot for pain. And we also advocate and communicate to their physicians in order to get them home safely or maybe stay overnight in the hospital. And to give you an idea what kind of surgeries, it can be any surgery. It can be anything from a hernia to open heart surgeries that we do. If I had more time with each patient, I would be able to give more time to their preoperative teaching. Now, again, here we are checking boxes, but preoperative teaching can be very few words nowadays, given the time we have to do this in. We also could have more time for the social, emotional, developmental issues that we deal with daily. We'd have more time for the physical assessment and not be rushing through those. We would also be able to observe more adequately for complications, of which I'll talk about in a minute, and better communicate with the patient's physicians so that things do not get missed before the patient actually gets into surgery, such as hypertension that could lead to higher risk of stroke. When those things are not done, patients experience more anxiety, fear. They experience mistakes on our part, errors, and injuries, including death. When I'm unable to do those things as a nurse, I feel frustrated, emotionally distressed, burnt out, and I don't want to come to work the next day. This is the environment we work in on a day-to-day basis. At times, it can feel unsafe. And at times, I feel that I cannot give safe patient care. One situation in which it was really hectic at work not too long ago, we had so many patients coming back from surgery at one time. One patient was returned to their room and not tended to for 1 hour. We had nurses working in every room. It was very, very busy. There was no communication between the transport person to a nurse when this patient arrived on the unit. This has happened more than once. I believe that nurses should work together to improve staffing and that staffing ratios equal safe patient care. Hospitals will not regulate themselves, we believe, and we need staffing standards in place, and most of all, we need a union to enforce the safe patient care. Thank you for listening.
Chair, may I ask a question?
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yes, Representative Greenman.
Can you tell me what the staffing ratio was on that day that you had a nurse in every room but a patient was still not seen?
On that day, it was probably about 8 patients per my 8-hour shift.
How many nurses in that unit?
In that unit, total? Good question. I know that we are down to very few regular nurses at this point. But we staff a lot with on-call nurses.
That day, how many nurses did you have on the floor?
I can't give you the exact number of nurses. I couldn't tell you without going back to the staffing schedule. But many days we come in and we have 6 to 7 add-on patients above and beyond.
Mm-hmm. How many patients were on the floor that day then? You know, you talked about
I would say we were at full capacity, so that would have had to have been about 17, 18 patients that day.
And what was the regular staffing ratio on this bill for that floor?
4 patients to 1 nurse.
So there would have been 4.5 nurses by that staffing ratio.
You know, the thing is the hospital gets away with scheduling just a nurse for maybe 2 to 4 hours at a time, so I'm not sure what the total number of nurses were that day as far as total FTEs, we call them, or full-time equivalents.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Yeah, thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Having watched the importance of family advocacy in terms of making sure that your loved one gets the attention they need, it's challenging for the nurses.
We're seeing that a lot more. A lot more families in.
Yeah. Thank you. And they're very patient with the persistent family members. So I need to call some folks who have signed up in opposition to the bill. Could I have Gwen Dayton, please? Martin Taylor, Oregon Nurses Association. Is Sue Davidson with you? Thank you. Gwen, do you want to go?
I'm glad to. Chair Kotek, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I've submitted written testimony, and I certainly hope that you will consider it, but I want to step aside from it for a moment and make an observation that the most important partnership that hospitals have is with its nurses. I mean, there is no question that we cannot provide the kind of quality care that our patients deserve and that we all expect to receive if we are in a hospital without a good, solid nursing staff that is also committed to the hospital. And it really was with that partnership in mind that the Hospital Association came together with the Oregon Nurses Association in 2005 and passed House Bill 2800. I was struck by the comment just a few minutes ago that hospitals won't regulate themselves. That's actually what we did in 2005. We sat down and through a series of compromises and sacrifices and setting aside our own self-interest on both sides of the conversation, crafted 2800. And that also involved significant commitment from the Legislative Assembly and a number of your colleagues as well, for which both organizations continue to be grateful. House Bill 2800 was passed in 2005, but really only became fully implemented in January of this year. There was a fairly extensive rulemaking period involving a number of stakeholders, including many of the people in this room that have testified today, to develop the rules. And because of that, the full requirements really only recently went into place. I think it's important to talk about what 2800 does, because I think in many ways the requirements of 2800 address much of what you've already heard today. House Bill 2800 requires a coming together of the hospital and its nursing staff. The core component or tenet of the bill is that a staffing plan for a hospital must be developed by a hospital nurse staffing committee. the nurse staffing committee has to be comprised of equal parts direct care bedside nurses and nurse managers. So direct care nurses now have a very strong say into what the staffing plan in their hospital looks like. When I was hearing the conversation recently in the last testimony about not checking boxes, there wasn't time to do that. First of all, no hospital would ask a nurse to do that. But my first thought was, well, if that's the case, why isn't that person going to their unit representative on the nurse staffing committee and bringing that problem, there's inadequate staffing in this unit to allow all the work to be done, bring that to the staffing committee. That's why the staffing committee was put together. It provides for that input from direct care nurses. Their colleagues are on this committee. That's how those issues can be addressed. It doesn't have to necessarily go through management if that's not a comfortable relationship. They can bring it to their colleagues who can bring it to the staffing committee. So through 2800, we've provided a vehicle to take on some of these issues. Let's think about what the criteria are for a staffing plan under 2800. Because they address many of the issues that have been brought up. The staffing plan has to be based on an accurate description of individual and aggregate patient needs and requirements. Include at least an annual quality evaluation process to determine whether the plan is working. Be based on the specialized qualifications and competencies of the nursing staff, nobody providing care in the OB unit that doesn't have that kind of training. Ensure that the skill mix and the competency of the staff meet the nursing care needs of the patients. Again, not having people who aren't trained in a particular area providing services in those areas. Be based on nationally recognized evidence-based standards. Recognize differences in patient acuteness. All those of us with an English background, acuity would have been a better term. Include a formal process for evaluating and initiating limitations on admissions. Nurses now have the ability to say, whoa, we're full up, we don't have enough staff. I want to ask the hospital to consider initiating its diversion process. And lastly, establish minimum numbers of nursing staff, including no less than one registered nurse and other nursing care staff on duty in a unit when a patient is present. These are some pretty strong criteria. Now, you've heard some concerns from others about, well, nothing's changed. You know, things are still bad in hospitals. And, well, we've only been doing this since January. The committees have only just been up and running. 2800 provides a very strong platform for the concerns you've heard to be addressed. It provides a strong platform not only for the development of a staffing plan that promotes safe patient care, but also for the development of trust and collaboration between direct care nurses and nurse managers. They now must come together and work on these issues together when before they were not. We hope that this collaboration and trust will provide not only strong staffing plans for 2007, but going forward provide the ability to continue to work together on staffing issues and other issues that are very difficult in this era of nursing shortages and tremendous stresses on the healthcare world. So we think House Bill 2800 has tremendous promise. We need to give it a chance to work before we destroy it in favor of something else. Thank you very much, and I'm glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Gwen. I appreciate the review of 2800. That's really helpful to have.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, Representative.
It's just a quick. Thanks, Gwen, for your testimony. House Bill 2800, it was implemented in January 06 or January 07?
Thank you, Representative.
Said January, but I think I heard.
I meant January of 07. I meant what I said, but it's confusing, and I acknowledge that. I appreciate the question so we can clarify it.
January 07.
Though. That's when effectively hospitals had to have a staffing plan in place developed by the staffing committee because it was in effect earlier, but because of the rulemaking process around what it meant to put together these committees and staffing plans, the actual requirement to have it in place was in January of 07.
Thank you.
Follow up on that. So did the rulemaking process take a year and a half?
Chair Kotek, yes, the rulemaking process took a long time. I can tell you it started out with some conversations between the ONA and the Hospital Association about what we could come to agreement on between ourselves. And we actually put together a great joint template on what these committees should look like. Those of you who have been in this building for a long time should understand that this wasn't a natural partnership necessarily. We came together and really set aside a lot of issues to do some good work. I'm frankly very proud of that, and I'm proud of the people that I'm up here at the table with. So we did that work to help the hospitals get started with their committees. And then the rulemaking process started. There were a number of stakeholder meetings that involved some of the folks that are here today as well. well as people at this table to figure out what we wanted in the rules. It did take a long time, quite frankly.
Thank you. Any questions? Martin or Sue? Who wants to go first? Thank you, Gwen.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. And I have to say, it's just a little bit awkward. There's a room full of nurses behind me, and typically I'm their champion, and today this is a room full of nurses who probably aren't real sure why we're up here. And I think that one of the reasons that we had to testify today is that it's important that we give a voice to our own position and you hear it right from us. The nurses in the room are folks that we work with. Many of them are members of AFT, which is one of the unions we consider our closest allies. They're folks that I've, you know, fought ballot measures with, testifying committees with, worked with on the rulemaking for 2800 for a year, and now it's a little awkward to look them in the eye, and that's an odd place to be. I have to say the person sitting next to me from the Hospital Association is also someone we're very close to. And that's a strange thing also for me to be saying. When I cut my teeth in this process in 2001 and we passed Hospital 2800, I think it's safe to say that there wasn't a bigger critic of hospitals in this building than ONA, and I was their lead person. So to get to a point where I...
That's 2800 in 2001.
We passed a first version in 2001 and a second version in 2005, which improved 2001's bill. That process was one where we had what we saw as sort of a natural adversary, and that has evolved considerably. The last legislative session for us was all about learning how to work with the Hospital Association, and that has not slowed down at all since the last legislative session. I think that you have new leadership and new vision in the association, and it's moved to many of its member hospitals. Not all. Certainly easier to see that where we have an ONA presence than where you have an unrepresented facility. But it is important in this process to give credit to people when they do the right thing. And the Hospital Association on this issue has been doing the right thing. And it would be wrong, frankly, for us to do anything other than come and testify against this bill today. We are midway in a process of trying to find out if you can create a safe environment for staffing using a model. It isn't a ratio model, but it is a joint governance model between direct care nurses and nurse managers over how to put together nurse staffing. And if in the middle of a good partnership with the hospitals on trying to make this work, we ducked, which would have been easy, it would have been wrong. So we're here. And I know it's hard for some of the folks in the room to understand because we work with them closely on many other issues. I want to say that personally, it's difficult too. I feel as if what we're trying to do in this state is develop a relationship of what ought to be natural allies but have been adversaries. The hospitals and nurses politically end up in an adversarial relationship oftentimes through collective bargaining and organizing, but when it comes to the job of providing patient care, there should be no more natural allies than nurses and hospitals. That should be what they're doing together. But putting together a committee made up equally of nurse managers and direct care nurses to determine what nurse staffing levels are, what we have achieved is putting nurses with a license, a common code of ethics, a common professional background, a common understanding of the job of nursing, and saying, between you are going to figure out what the patients in your unit need. I should say this about 2800 too. It is weighted towards the direct care nurses, and that if that equal number of direct care nurses and nurse managers cannot agree, the hospitals face the possibility of civil penalties. So ultimately, the nurses in that situation have a greater degree of leverage. We try not to make that the point of the bill, but in terms of trying to find an effective way to staff hospitals, arguably, the nurses in that situation have as much control over the ratio process as anyone. If they want a ratio, they could drive a ratio through their hospital system using that process. We have a clinical expert who's going to explain to you what we actually do, and it's much more based on identifying the individual patient need and the individual skill mix of nurses, which is where ratios, in our opinion, frequently fall down. This bill is more than a ratio bill. It builds back onto a ratio and acuity system. In principle, we don't see the ratio model as the more effective way of doing nurse staffing, because a ratio model in itself treats a nurse as a nurse as a nurse and doesn't look at the individual competencies of nurses. And looks at each patient as the same, not looking at their comorbidities or various needs. Now, there's some some protections here and here against that, but when you hear conversation among nurses both nationally and the state between ratios and what we call an acuity-based staffing system, we really try to empower nurses to look at the acuity of each unit in each system. Okay, the last thing I want to really bring forward is that to us this is one of the ironies is that many of the nurses in the room today that are OFN members come from Kaiser, which is one of the real models of doing this right. Kaiser is tremendous in their partnership. It is a variance between where you have the best relationship between employers and employees and another system that is unorganized, where you have potentially the least constructive interaction on things like this nurse staffing committee. And I think that we know that the direction of trying to get hospitals and direct care nurses to work together to solve problems is the correct direction. We also know that that may not work at unrepresented facilities. And what we're really asking is give us some time to see if this is something that can translate into not just represented hospitals and unrepresented hospitals. And if it can't, in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years down the road, it's clear that you really have two different systems, a place where the law is followed and it's intended, and a place that's not really followed. We will be here talking with you about finding alternatives. But we would like time to try to make this work.
Thank you. Sue, did you want to add on to that?
I'll make it brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kotek and members of the committee. My comments are available to you, and also I've provided you with packets.
Thank you.
Some of the packets that we use when we do training sessions for nurses to participate in this very important work around HB 2800.
Could you just introduce yourself for the
Yes, moment? I'm Sue Davidson. I'm the Nursing Assistant Executive Director for Professional Services, which includes nursing practice, nursing education, and the research activities of ONA. It is wonderful to be here because our colleagues in the room share a common concern with us about nurse staffing. That's not a question that brings us together. Where we have differences is how, and Martin has eloquently spoken about how we're unfolding this and what it means to us. I just want to draw back your attention to the difference between where we started and where we are now. We began with nurses being free to offer their input about staffing plans, and we have now come to a system or a situation with collaborative partners in a committee. And if there were any two partners to have, it would be the two that are created by 2800, the 05 version. So I won't go any further than to say this is a big move from giving input to being across the table from others, not in a negotiating sense, but certainly in a sense of coming together around understanding what is best for the group of patients we're caring for today. And so I want to focus then on this issue of the ratio approach versus the one that is inherent to 2800 currently. In a ratio, you start with a relationship between a patient and a nurse, 1 to 8, 1 to 2, whatever it might be. And what that does is place you in a box. You must meet that ratio. When, in fact, in clinical practice, we all know that sometimes ratios are wrong. Sometimes what is a 1-to-2 relationship, typical of very acute care areas, should be 1-to-1. Sometimes it should be different. So we're a part of why we have gone a different route, which is to say locally you need to have a means by which in your facility you can flex up, flex down, but you must always have the relationship of a nurse to a group of patients, of an experienced nurse with patients who are very ill, with a less experienced nurse, but what we call newbies or somebody who's learning, with a group of patients that have diversity but aren't so acutely ill. So partially we're suggesting that if you begin with ratios, it puts you in a box. And as one of your previous folks who gave testimony said, there was a day when it should have been something and it wasn't, and that was because there weren't people to fill that need. But I don't want to end there. I want to say something about what I think is one of the superb parts of this activity, and that is in the rulemaking process, we did come up with a definition of safe patient care, thus linking the efforts of this bill not to what's really nice, what's really, really good, but to what is safe. If there was anything we should orbit our work and staffing around, it would be that patients are safe when they receive the care. And in addition, there's specific language in the bill which to describes when it probably isn't safe. Those are two really meaningful parts of the bill, which I think give our colleagues in the health division who do the surveys some understanding of what it would look like if it's not doing what it should. Do we know where we're at? I did a rough tally of the facilities that ONA works with, and 23 out of 32, which is 70% by our count, this may not be perfect to the health division, but have formed their hospital nurse staffing committee. And these committees, though, are all over the map in terms of where they're at in the process of addressing nurse staffing. Since the adoption of the new rules on October 5th of 06, over 300 staff nurse leaders have received training related to these rules, how to write or revise their unit level staffing plan, and how to participate in a hospital nurse staffing committee. And then finally, according to the 2000 to 2005 report on hospitals in Oregon from the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research, 2007, RN staff expanded 22%, outpacing the increase in hospital admissions. Now, while this expansion of the nurse staffing body within the state is modest, I believe it suggests a recognition that increased numbers of patients from hospital admissions require increased numbers of nurses. That hasn't always been so abundantly clear.
Sue, could you just wrap up? Thank you.
I'm done.
I just finished. So thank you. Thank you so much. And I know a lot of hard work has come into 2800, and I really appreciate the hospitals and the Nurse Association for being here. Thank you very much. We had a lot of people signed up to speak in favor of this, so I'm going to use chair's prerogative in deference to the folks that are here. I'd like to do two more nurses, then we're going to have to wrap it up. So the two last folks need to be brief. Could I have Leanne Park and Mo Fox, please? Introduce yourself for the record, and like I said, if you could keep it brief, that would be great.
My name is Leanne Park. I work at Legacy Health System, and I'm here with United Nurses of Legacy. I actually can speak directly to the House Bill 2800 process. I was deeply involved in, we probably had 10 different work groups going over the administrative rules and trying to reach a determination that would be a compromise between all of the parties. And both the Oregon Hospital Association and ONA are very correct when they say that this was definitely a table where everyone came together and worked on it together, and it was kind of precedent-setting and very amazing that we could come to terms with something that would address nurse staffing. Unfortunately, it did not address it adequately. I work in an unrepresented facility, which means as nurses we do not have a protection of contract. So I am susceptible and vulnerable to firing for anything without precedent. I'm an at-will employee. And Legacy has implemented their House Bill 2800 committee. We have already established the nurse leaders who would be speaking on that committee. The direct nurse ratio to managers has all been set, and all of our first meetings have been had. I actually was a backup person, the person who represented my unit, and I are close friends, and we spoke after he came back. And it basically was an effective shutout. They were handed the staffing plan that Legacy had at that time and said, sign this, and we won't be meeting again ever. And if anyone on that committee speaks up, they will be terminated. They have really no one to report to, and our concerns were not at all addressed. And I do believe that at some point by working together, maybe over the course of many, many years, we may be able to somehow strong arm or kindly encourage Legacy to step up and self-regulate. However, if any of my family members are hospitalized at Legacy in the next 6 to 12 years, or however long that process takes, I will certainly be at their bedside because there won't be a nurse there. This is just a very, very powerful issue. I do believe House Bill 2800 brought up some very pertinent things. However, we fell far short of what we could do for the citizens of Oregon, and we've fallen far short of what other states currently are doing for their citizens. And we have a choice to make now. We can wait and see if history repeats itself, and see if we have an overwhelming
turn where nurses are suddenly valued and patient care is suddenly centered, or we can accept what is truly a minimum staffing ratio. I believe Sue Davidson brought up an excellent point where she said it's very frequent that the ratios do not accurately reflect the acuity of patient care situations. You have 1 to 2 nurse staffing in critical care, and very quickly, very frequently, patients can turn into a one-on-one patient or even a two-on-one patient. I work in ICU, and frequently we need 2 nurses to do damage control in a very urgent situation. However, that's why this is a minimum ratio. This is a foundation. It's a starting point. It's a starting block. And by identifying the minimum and moving from there, I think that we actually might have the power to affect the quality of patient care, which is why we are all here in this room. So I encourage you to read my statement on the hearing testimony. It's actually another very scary incident of when unsafe staffing jeopardized the quality of the patient's care that my patients received. And it's just another small voice in the cry for the desperate need of change. And I encourage you guys to identify how House Bill 3416 does not necessarily replace House Bill 2800. In fact, we would definitely continue to encourage the hospital association meeting with us and compromising and working together in a very valuable partnership. However, we really, really need to set a minimum. And we're not the first to do it, and I really don't want us to be the last.
Thank you, Leanne. And if you could speak.
Yeah. My name is Maureen Fox. Mo is my nickname, M-A-U-R-E-E-N. I am a nurse.
I'm going to give a minute, Mo, because.
Okay. I first wanted to say that I'm very honored to be here. I am the future. I've only been a nurse for 5 years, so I will be the one who will replace the nurses that are retiring. I want to just share a quick story. I've worked in Kaiser. I worked for Kaiser in California for a year in the emergency room. I was a brand new nurse recruited out of nursing school. When I started my position, it was normal for an emergency room nurse to take 8 to 10 patients. Because this was my very first position in a hospital, the learning curve was a 90-degree angle. My very first night was a shocker for me. The nurse that was precepting me had been a nurse for 6 months. She had a very large patient load, 8 patients. And one of the patients had been extremely intoxicated and had been very belligerent. And that time, anybody who was belligerent or out of control would immediately go into 4-point leather restraints, not the soft restraints that we use now, leather restraints. And we did this very frequently. And we smudged the paperwork so that it looked like it was legal and for the safety of the patient and the staff. This particular patient was removed from her, the restraints were removed from her ankle so that she could use a bedpan to relieve herself. And the nurse put her on the bedpan and then quickly left and went to go and care for her very large patient load. About an hour later, we heard a crash and a scream. The patient had gotten free of one restraint and was hanging off of the gurney. I'm sorry. She was naked. There was urine all over the floor, and she had broken her hip. This was the beginning of my nursing career, and I swore that day that I would never, ever allow a patient to be harmed under my care. And unfortunately, for that next year, I, too, cared for 8 to 10, even 11 patients at a time in a very busy 35-bed emergency room. There were times when I would drive home crying and praying to God that I had not hurt a patient. I am not over-exaggerating. I take my care for my patients very seriously. I work in the emergency room now. I work in labor delivery, both very acute settings and postpartum. And I want to be able to provide safe care. I do not feel that it is safe to be in an acute care setting where I have multiple patients, multiple medications to give, multiple things to think about, and that the last thing, my last priority, is that they're actually having a satisfactory experience in my hospital. I feel like I care for the tip of the iceberg in those situations. And patients are so complex, they need us to be able to care for the whole picture. And so with that, I won't take up any more of your time. This is such an important issue, and I ask that you will give it very serious consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mom. And I, please.
No, thank you. I need to close the hearing. I just want to thank all of you who are the nurses in the audience, the work you do, and thank you for being here today. And just for the record, we have written testimony from Terry Cummings, Danelle Owens, and David Hertzfeld for the record. And also Dr. Marvin Fickle from the Oregon State Hospital. And again, thank you for coming in. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3416. We need to move on to some other bills here. And with that, committee, I actually need to, I have an appointment in Portland, so I'm passing the gavel to Vice Chair Bonamici. Thank you. Thank you for caring. Okay, we're going to stand at ease for just a moment until the room is quiet. Sandy, would you please give us a summary of the Dash 1 amendments that we have?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 2867, you'll recall, modifies the definition of dental hygiene to include the assessment for and to apply dental sealants and fluoride, deletes the requirement of the 5,000 hours of the supervised dental hygienist clinical practice within the previous 5 years as an educational requirement before receiving a limited access permit for a dental hygienist. It authorizes the permit holder to assess the need for and to apply the dental sealants. It has an emergency clause and is effective on passage. During our public hearing on March 15th, we heard from the Dental Hygienist Association, and they had some recommended language for amendments. You do have those Dash 1 amendments in front of you. Additionally, you have a hand engrossed of those amendments. I do believe that we have a representative of the association here to walk us through the amendments and answer any questions of the subcommittee. And that is...
thank you, Ms. Cosgrove. Kathleen Cosgrove is here to tell us about the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you, Kathleen. Members of the committee, Representative Bonamici. Thank you. I'm Kathleen Cosgrove. I'm here today representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists. At the request of the committee, the Dental Hygienists Association has been meeting with the Oregon Dental Association, who I believe is also here today, and we were able to agree on all of the issues that we differed on, with the exception of one. And are pleased to come to you today with that. Basically, what we were asked to do was to come up with some language relating to the definition of the dental hygienist and the sealants, and all of the parties agreed to that. That language is included in the Dash 1 amendments. The one issue that I believe you'll find that there's still a little bit of difference of opinion is on the number of hours that are required of clinical experience for a dental hygienist before they can apply for their LAP permit. And the Oregon Dental Hygienists, as we stated on March 15th, feel that that number should be zero. We heard from some dentists, Dr. Empey and Dr. Love, why they believe that no further clinical training is needed. We also believe this. The reason that we have formed this opinion is that we do have dental hygienists in rural communities that are having a hard time obtaining their limited access permit because they're not able to get the current requirement of 5,000 hours in the 5 years, and that's why we recommended zero. We also have one of the Portland Community College teachers who teaches
the clinical practice for dental hygiene who would like to get her limited access permit, but because she doesn't have clinical experience, is not able to do that. So that's the background between the 0 hours that was in the original piece of legislation. What we have submitted to you is a compromise figure of 2,000 hours, but are interested in deferring to the committee on where they think this number would be and are willing to accept any kind of reasonable compromise that Representative Greenlick would like to offer.
Thank you very much. Do we have somebody from the ODA here to talk about Margie?
Representative Chair Bonamici?
Vice Chair
Bonamici. Sorry, I haven't testified a lot. Members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Dental Association and here to testify in support of the intent of this bill. We have really enjoyed working with the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association on a good bill that we feel will help provide access to affordable health care, oral health care for our state's most vulnerable populations. Currently, as Kathleen stated, the negotiating point that we're having trouble with at the moment is the hours, and I will echo what she says, that we'll defer to the committee for what you guys think is a reasonable compromise on that. The Oregon Dental Association believes that the 5,000-hour requirement is a good requirement because it enables people to get adequate training in order to provide the best care possible to our most vulnerable populations. Currently, and according to the Oregon Board of Dentistry, 75% of dental hygienists qualify for a limited access permit, but they are not seeking the limited access permits. And when we started talking with the Oregon Dental Hygienists, we wanted to talk about an incentive-based program to encourage those dental hygienists that currently qualify to obtain an LAP so that they can actually get out there into these communities and start servicing the providing oral health care for seniors and children. We also recognize that dental hygienists in school in the 2.5-year program that they attend get 1,500 hours of clinical experience. So we're willing to come down to 3,500 hours for a requirement to get an LAP because that number plus the 1,500 hours would be 3 years of experience if you're working as a full-time hygienist and 6 years as a part-time hygienist. Again, we firmly believe that the sticking point that's holding people back from getting LAP permits and the reason that there are only 71 is because dental hygienists are volunteering their time. They're getting the LAP and they're volunteering their time. And we would like to focus more on incentives to encourage hygienists to get the LAP, to get out there to provide oral exams for our state's most vulnerable populations.
Thank you. And Ms. Cosgrove, did you want to make one more point? And then I'm going to turn to Representative Greenlick with a question.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. I'd like to thank the ODA for bringing up the question of whether or not LAPs are volunteering their time or getting paid for these services, and appreciate that being brought to the attention of the committee. And I think that's a longer discussion for another time. I did want to add just as a point of clarification that 75% of the dental hygienists, according to the Board of Dentistry, work 1,000 hours or more per year. In order to get an LAP license, a dental hygienist has to be active in their profession, have an active dental hygiene license, and take an additional 40 hours in classes in addition to having the clinical hours. So it's not as though these dental hygienists are eligible for the LAP. They can take the classes and then become eligible should they have enough hours.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, we've been batting numbers around. This is a good bill, and I think you guys have done a great job of coming together. And, Margie, I was wondering whether 2,500 hours would give you too much heartburn to just get this deal closed.
I'm authorized by my client to say that we believe that 3,500 hours is sufficient training, and we believe that to be a reasonable amount of time for dental hygienists, because what we're concerned about is that people get the clinical experience with, particularly with follow-up for patients, and it's really important because they're not trained to give full oral exams like dentists are, that they see what follow-up looks like at 6 months, a year. And they also get an experience working with patients who have never seen a dentist before, or patients who may have, mental handicaps that make them more difficult to work with. And so what we want to make sure, again, is go back to the reasonable amount of time that is required to send these people out into vulnerable populations.
Madam Chair, my recommendation is then that if you would be willing to pass the dash ones as they are and move the bill with or without recommendation to the full committee, I'll try and meet with the parties between now and 3 o'clock tomorrow. Let's see if I can get a little movement. If not, I'll make a recommendation tomorrow.
I'm willing to do that. Does anybody else on the committee want to weigh in on that? Although I must say that back when I was practicing law, when we'd get to this situation, we'd simply split the difference. So
yeah,
that
I
would be
I was
my inclination.
The difference between the number 3,000 that I had heard in some conversation and the number 2,000, but the number 3,000 switched to 3,500, which I'm sure never happened to you in the negotiations we were doing. unless they moved to 4,000.
Anybody else, Representative Flores or Representative Bruin, Representative
I don't think
Gelser?
It makes a huge difference.
No, I was just going to say I appreciated Representative Greenwich's recommendation at 2,500 hours, and pending some further negotiations or discussion, I would be very happy to move the Dash 1 amendments at this point.
Thank you. Representative Flores has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2867. Are there any objections? Do I need to do a roll call for that? No. We've adopted the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2867, and I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2867 to the full committee as amended. What would you prefer that I say?
I think that's fine.
No recommendation?
With
a do-pass recommendation. Thank you.
Any objections or discussion? Yeah, can we have the roll call, please?
Aye.
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 Aye. Excuse.
Excuse.
I can excuse you, I imagine.
Thank you. House Bill 2867 with the Dash 1 amendments has been moved to the full Health Care Committee. And Representative Greenlick, would you like to present that to our committee tomorrow? Because you will be the one with the knowledge.
Madam Administrator, will you alert LC that we will have a one-number potential amendment tomorrow of some unknown number?
I just want to say thank you very, very much to members of the committee for being open to discussion about this, and we really appreciate working with ODHA and with all of you to pass this good bill.
Thank you both so much. It would be nice if you two guys came to me tomorrow with a number.
we're working on it.
Stay together there in your discussion. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Get your poker cards.
I have no poker face.
Close the work session. Do I guess? Close the work session and open a work session on House Bill 2524.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 2524 is before us yet again. This time we have a Dash 5 amendments that I believe are in good shape. That's a safe word to say it. We also have before us that the committee should still have in their folder are the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments. This bill is the acquired infection reporting bill. We've had a public hearing and several other versions of amendments. I believe that Bruce Bishop and maybe Tom are here to walk us through the amendments and answer any questions of the subcommittee.
And Lauren Rhodes as well.
Yes, when you want to get to the ones in the twos.
And I'm actually prepared to explain Section 8.
Of the dash five.
Section 9 of the dash five.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. I look forward to that.
Oh, are you prepared to do 2018? You do it then, Madam Chair.
Oh, no, I look forward to your explanation. Not to me.
This was complicated. This whole thing sunsets in 2018. And what Section 9 is in the original bill, it adds something to Section 7, the original amendments. So the original ORS 442445 adds, or Section 3 of this 2007 Act. When the whole thing sunsets, you have to take that away. And the way you take it away is by Section 8, which simply, as you can see, deletes or Section 3 of this 2007 Act. Section 8, therefore, becomes effective on January 2nd, 2018, when the rest of it sunsets. So the whole effect of this double shift for those people who follow baseball, it's like putting the pitcher out in right field while you bring in another pitcher, is to simply put ORS 442.445 back in its original form when the amendments to it sunset.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Now, Representative Kelser.
I had a question. I really appreciated Representative Greenlick, the bulleted update explanation that helped me in preparing for this hearing. And I don't know if we're going to hear from some of the stakeholders, but one of the concerns that I heard in our last couple of hearings were about ensuring that we're not requiring duplicate reporting for nursing facilities and other facilities represented by the Oregon Healthcare Association. And I wanted to make sure to hear from them that issue had been addressed the way they needed it addressed.
Right. Lauren Rhodes is here, and we can have her come up and talk about that right now and do the amendments in numerical order then. Lauren, would you like to come and talk about the dash ones and the dash twos, please?
Or other possibilities.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association, and yes, in the original bill, we were concerned about requiring reporting of infection measures, which nursing facilities are already required to report under federal and state law to both the Department of Human Services and also the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And what we had attempted to achieve in the dash ones, which are different from the dash twos, was to just remove long-term care facilities from this new reporting requirement and the new entity that was created. And that is under that concept of avoiding reporting the same measures. Now, that would be absent new measures that might come up that the newly formed commission or committee would be interested in receiving, and then we'd be happy to comply with that. The dash twos were an attempt, and I'm not sure they're actually worded necessarily to achieve this goal, but to ask that the Department of Human Services transmit the report that we already submit to them to a newly formed entity, whether it's through the Office of Health Policy and Research, or in this case it is now. That was our goal, and really the policy behind it is just that we are sending these electronic reports in an electronic format required by the federal government on a quarterly basis for every resident in a long-term care facility, and to require that same report to be sent a second time seems, in our opinion, burdensome, and we'd, you know, quite honestly prefer to have an RN who is responsible for providing care really doing that instead of submitting additional paperwork to another agency. So that's what we'd like to see trying to occur, and in conversations that I've had with several of you, we're happy to work. If there's another way to do it in a separate amendment, we're happy to work on that as well. But that's what the dash ones and twos do.
Madam Chair, if I can ask, you have the dash fives?
I do.
After we met, I read the dash fives again, and I wonder if you would look at page 2, line 15 through 20. whether that's sort of like the wording we thought we'd try and get today.
Vice Chair, Representative Greenlick, I do, and I actually have it underlined, and I had a note to that. I think that is getting at where we're going. I think, I guess I don't understand quite the wording that they used in terms of aligning the requirements. I'd want to maybe see if we can get a different word in there. I think align sounds like, to me at least, if other entities were required to report, maybe it would be asking those additional entities to submit similar reports. I guess is sort of how I read that, and I could be reading it incorrectly, but I think the intent is there, yes, I would agree with you. And I think that we could certainly get at what we needed to get at with maybe a couple wording changes.
Madam Chair, maybe we can do the same thing then. Maybe we can, if there's no other objection when we hear testimony, pass this on to tomorrow, give Lauren and Jim another day to take a look at it and see if this does it or if we can, if they have a couple of words that to strengthen this bill. This sounds like what I think we reached agreement on earlier this afternoon.
Yes, Representative Flores. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think as far as the alignment issue of duplicate reporting, that's covered in that particular paragraph, but I don't see that if I understood the goal of the Oregon Healthcare Association to remove them from the reporting requirement, it would be covered in that paragraph.
No, I think we reached agreement this afternoon that they would be okay with it as long as basically what they could do is send the state the same thing they send the federal government. And if this wording doesn't get to that, then I think we agreed we'd try and find some wording before we pass this out that did get to that, that basically said, it's not a problem sending data. We'll just, as long as we're sending you the same data in the same form, fine, we'll do that. What they didn't want is another set of forms and another set of requirements.
Representative Gelser had a question.
Yeah, I wanted to, because I thought that I had understood the concern a little bit differently, that it wasn't so much sending the same form to both places, but if that industry is already regulated by reporting requirements and they're reporting to a different entity which is monitoring and publishing the results, I think the desire was to not have to do that to two places because it was duplicative.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Greenlick, Representative Gelser, I actually think, yes, a little bit of, to everything. The way that the reports are currently submitted, they're transmitted electronically first to the Department of Human Services. So they actually have them in their possession. They are then transmitted a second time to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So what our interest is asking somehow for language to be in there that simply achieves the goal of asking the department to send existing information and reports it has onto the Office of Health Policy and Research, since it is the same report. It isn't a second report. And in Representative Green, a conversation we had with Representative Greenlick, we were, again, avoiding a second form, but it's the same format that goes to the Department of Human Services and to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. A different format would be problematic, in our opinion. And so that's why I think there's a little bit of finessing that I think we can achieve. I don't think it would be difficult to achieve in the language.
I have a quick question. Because if we were considering still the Dash 1 amendments, I appreciate your willingness to be open to reporting additional information if the requirements change, and I'm concerned that if there's an exemption as provided by the Dash 1 amendments, then there wouldn't be any way to capture that responsibility later. So I would prefer the approach that's in the Dash 2 or with amending the Dash 5 if that's something that everybody else agrees with. I don't think any of us want to see duplication. We just want to find a way to make sure that additional, I know I want to make sure to find a way to recognize your willingness to report any additional information that's added later.
And Madam Chair, I think what resonates with me is that these facilities that are being the focus here they are smaller, they don't have this extensive staff, administrative type staff that the larger facilities do, and that's why that duplicative reporting or re-reporting is, I think, would create some sort of a extra burden on smaller resources, and with Ms. Rhodes saying rather have a nurse taking care of a patient than doing this type of administrative work.
Perhaps Representative Greenland.
Yes, ma'am.
Perhaps
the masters. Here.
Would it be helpful to have somebody explain, just walk through the dash five?
Well, I think it would. We were just talking about the one issue.
Right. Exactly. I think before we take action on how we address that, because that might be addressed when we get to page two of the dash five amendment. So, is there somebody here to walk through the dash five amendments? Okay. Bruce Bishop and Tom. Can we have both of you and see if we can shed some light on this? Thank you.
Vice Chair Bonamici and members of the subcommittee, I'm Tom Powers, and I work for Representative Greenlick as a legislative assistant, and I kind of took the liberty of pulling together the electronic work group by email and seeing if we could resolve the issues from the dash threes, which were later to become the dash fours, and now the dash fives, which are in front of you, accompanied with an updated bulleted summary, which I'm just kind of going to walk through along with the document over here, and Mr. Bishop, please interrupt as you see necessary to correct anything that I misrepresent. So the most important part that I want to address is that this, along with the dash fours and the dash fives, I'll just say dash fives, okay, because the dash fours, first of all, are very similar to the dash fives, except for the dash fives have that corrected sunset provision that Representative Greenlick mentioned to you. So the dash five amendments also include an explicit mention of infection measures that must be reported in addition to rates. That's including but not limited to rates. So actual infection rates must be reported. The previous edition had said only information must be reported, and that was, I believe, construed by members of the subcommittee to be too vague. The next big change is what the committee has just discussed with the Oregon Healthcare Association. It's that page 2, line 15, subsection 3, it encourages the style of reports to be similar to the Department of Human Services, to that which needs to be submitted to the Department of Human Services and the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare and Medicaid Services, and that's to accommodate the facilities that already report infection rates to these institutions to produce the duplicative reporting. We had also come to a consensus, or at least a working consensus in the work group, that there should be a phase-in for the reporting program, as these measures would there would have to be some established methodology for the reporting and also the gathering of the measures and the eventual public disclosure of those measures. And I think that is included in Section 3 here, that actually Section 4, that it must be made public no later than 2010. We also had discussed during a previous meeting, work session on this bill, that there was something that exists currently in Section 3, subsection 7 of the Dash 5 amendments. It clarifies the applicability of records eligible for subpoena or agency enforcement to just those individual records that were submitted to the healthcare acquired infection reporting program, so that if individual healthcare information was acquired by the healthcare acquired infection reporting program, it could not be used in a regulatory fashion. Some of the last changes that we had that were more administrative were that the change of the makeup of the advisory committee, it includes two representatives who are hospital administrators, one from a hospital with more than 100 beds and one from a hospital with fewer than 100 beds, both of which must have, the bill says expertise, and Mr. Bishop will construe that, argue that that should be construed maybe a little bit more liberally than in the bill, because there are not a tremendous amount of hospital administrators that have strict expertise in the area of infection control. Some of the last changes, just to summarize, it requires that the advisory committee consider specific types of infections. I know that the subcommittee during one of the previous work sessions had expressed kind of dismay that the earlier version of the bill that said you had to look at different types of infections, such as urinary tract infections and I believe respirator acquired pneumonia was another one. I think now the committee is encouraged to look, at least consider specific types of infections as well as process measures so that those measures are a part of the process. And finally, it changes the sunset glitch that was present in the Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Mr. Bishop?
Vice Chair Bonamici, members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. As one of your constituents, Representative Bonamici, it's a privilege to see you having a gavel, particularly given the comments that the chair of the committee made yesterday about me, which I take to be a personal insult. So I'm glad that you're in charge of this hearing.
I wasn't even there to hear the bad statement.
And I'm sure you won't repeat it. We are here in support of the Dash 5 amendments. We appreciate the consideration of the committee and the work of Representative Greenlick's staff in pulling together those amendments. We think that the Dash 5 amendments take a really positive step forward in developing an appropriate infections reporting system for Oregon, not just adopting a model from another state that appears not to be working very well. So I think We're building a strong foundation so that this program can advance and provide information that patients want to know, but probably as importantly that healthcare facilities and providers want to know so that they can continue to address the kinds of problems that occur in those settings. So we think the Dash 5 amendments are a good statement of law and would urge their adoption.
Thank you very much for your support and your flattering comments. And also, I want to commend Representative Greenlick and his staff for working so hard on this. Are there any questions of Mr. Powers or Mr. Bishop? Okay. Any questions? No. Committee, would you like some more information? We have people here from the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. Do you want to hear some more information before we start talking about the amendments and adopting the amendments?
I wonder if they would like to come.
For the record, Janine Smith, Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research, and we've worked closely with the Hospital Association, and our efforts of what we have already been doing in the hospital quality indicator work is very similar to the process that's been outlined here in the Dash 5s, and we feel that it fits with what we've seen nationally and in other states as an approach and follows national suggestions and guidelines and the consensus that the Patient Safety Commission has pulled together of all the experts in Oregon, and we think that Dash 5s really do meet that need that of fulfilling the desires of having a good hospital health facility acquired infection reporting.
Thank you so much.
If you have any questions for us, we're open to them.
Thank you so much. I want to let the committee know we have just a couple of minutes before we lose our quorum. So I would entertain a motion on the Dash 5 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill, what?
2524. Any discussion? Any opposition? Okay. The Dash 5 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2524.
Madam Chair, I want to look at the dash ones and the dash twos again. I mean, what's the committee? What are we talking about?
We'll see it again tomorrow.
Is that how we're going to address it?
Right.
Okay.
And Representative Greenlick, would you like to take the same approach with this and figure out whether the dash ones or twos or fives can be combined in a way that meets the needs?
I think we clearly don't want to exclude the long-term care facilities, and they're prepared not to be excluded as long as they don't have to do anything other than what they already do now. So I think we can make sure the language, I hope we can perfect the language by tomorrow. If not, we'll hold off another week. But I hope we can perfect what we need by tomorrow to make them content.
And do you feel confident in the ability to do that with the dash fives, or should we adopt the dash twos to give legislative counsel something to do?
I think the dash fives do what we need, and if we need to modify it, we need to modify something in that section we talked about before.
Section 3, whatever. I think the dash 2 is overreach.
Okay, then I will entertain a motion to move House Bill 2524-5 to the full health care committee. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. I just do want to make sure, and I'm not tied to them having to be the dash twos, and I agree that the dash ones don't work because we don't want to exclude, but I do want to be sure before we move it out of the committee that we're able to address those concerns in whatever format that is.
And do you mean before we move it out of the full health care committee or before we move out of the subcommittee?
Can we do that work tomorrow after we've adopted?
Or not.
Can we amend an amendment to a
sure.
bill?
Yes.
Well, we'll have a bill as amended before us tomorrow.
Right.
Okay.
If we need to amend something else, we can amend it.
And I believe we're in agreement that we want to address the needs to avoid the duplication of the long-term care facility. Hey, is there a motion to move the House Bill 2524 with the dash 5 amendments to the full health care committee?
I would move House Bill 2524 as amended to the full health care committee.
Representative Gelser has moved House Bill 2524 as amended with the dash 5 amendments to the full health care committee. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Byrne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to vote yes, but I want to go on record as this is a courtesy vote to get it to the full committee. I'm still reserving. This is a big change. I've got concerns about the big change in general, and I still have concerns about the long-term health care facilities until those are fully resolved. This is a courtesy vote.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Flores?
Thank you. That very much expresses my concern as well, just to make sure that these are addressed, the concerns of the long-term health care facilities. And obviously it is a policy decision that's a little grand in nature and not opposed to new things, but still, you know, have those growing pains perhaps, but also wanting to make sure that the concerns are taken care of before we move it one step further from the full committee.
Right. And we all share those concerns.
We don't have to have this vote. I can simply withdraw from the full committee. We can deal with it again tomorrow if you prefer not to vote.
I would be happy to withdraw my motion if Representative Greenlick is comfortable having it come back to the policy committee on Thursday.
No, I'm going to move it out to the full committee tomorrow. All I'm saying is I don't need a vote to do that. So I would be happy. If you're uncomfortable about moving it to the full committee, where we'll be addressing it tomorrow.
Representative
Greenlick.
I can
withdraw it from this committee to the full committee. I'm happy to do that.
You're not being an authoritarian with us, are you?
No, I'm being a committee chair.
Oh, okay.
Well, there is a motion on the table.
There is a motion on the table, and I suggest we vote on the motion because everybody's expressed our concerns. I think we have enough on the record that we're in agreement that we need to address the concerns of the long-term care facilities. And before we move it out of the full health care.
And Madam Chair, when I made my motion, I don't think that I completed it. Given the discussion here, can I complete the sentence, move it to the full committee without recommendation?
Oh, okay. Please do. Representative Gelser has moved House Bill 2524 as amended with the dash 5 amendments to the full health care committee without a recommendation.
As amended.
As amended. Further discussion? Well, can the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Kotek.
Excused.
Vice Chair Bonamici.
Aye. The House Bill 2524 with a dash 5 amendments has been moved to the full Health Care Committee without a recommendation. Representative Greenlick, I know you're also presenting the other. Would you be willing to present this tomorrow to the full Health Care Committee?
Yes.
Thank you, Representative.
We have other business tomorrow, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'll
close the work session on House Bill 2524. And seeing no further business, close the subcommittee meeting.